on the air.
Be careful with what you say, you know.
Well, these tapes won't be used against you as they were against Nixon. This is strictly a private matter. You can even swear, and it won't go down to the pages of history.
Well, I don't think I feel like swearing this morning.
You wouldn't?
No, I don't.
Louis always has something to swear at, but Esther is much...
I don't swear. I say something that says my prayers.
Is that going to be taped?
Well, the machine is going, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
You know, Beth Allen, speaking of swearing and prayers, Beth Allen was telling me a nice story the other day about a local gent. This is a true story. Mm-hmm. He very pious, went to church every Sunday, and he also had prayers for the family, including the hired man. And they were kneeling at their kitchen chairs one afternoon when he looked out and he saw the bull got loose in the garden. So he said to the hired man, "Jake, go out and get that goddamn bull out of the garden. Amen."
I'll just read, started to read it. A funny little
that's
story.
The best, that's the best thing I ever heard.
Written by a Vermonter called The Day That No Pigs Died. Have you heard of it?
No.
It's written in the Vermont vernacular, just exactly, and it's written about a Shaker family. The Shaker family. It's very interesting reading it just the way you'd hear some Vermonter tell the story. And the story opens, the first chapter is about a young boy, 12 years old, whose neighbor's cow is going to have a calf, and he meets her in the pasture, and this cow is moaning with pain, and this 12-year-old boy goes over to her. Her name is Apron. You know why they call her Apron? Because she's all black, but she has white right from her neck down to her belly, just in the front of her, or in the side of her, or what part you call that. And so they call her Apron. And he helps her have that calf. And beside, she moans and moans terribly. So he doesn't know what to do about her. So he takes off his trousers, and he ties it to a post. And then he ties it on to the head of the calf that's trying to be born. And he pulls it, and he gets the calf out, but then she's still moaning, and guess what? And he puts her hand into her mouth, and he pulls out a goiter that she has.
Pull out what?
A goiter. The cow had a goiter.
Ooh.
And the boy, of course, he pulled it off. A goiter, you know what a goiter is? Of course, he falls down. He's just 12 years old, and he falls into a lot of prickly thorns, and he gets his backside pretty sore. And
he has no pants on.
They bring him home, and he has to go to bed. And the conversation between he and his father is just wonderful. Then the neighbor, whose cow she had two. She had two calves, one a male and the other a female. And after the cow gets better, the neighbor brings these two animals over to show the boy what he did. And he wants to do everything for the boy, but it's against the Shaker policy to do anything for anything good you've done.
Yeah.
You've done it, and it's done, and that's all there is to it. But after a while, the neighbor comes and brings the boy a new little piglet. And, the boy is just delighted with it. And he thinks he can put the pig with the cows and the dogs and everything. And the father explains to him that a pig is a wild animal.
Pig is a pig.
Yeah, a pig is a wild animal, and you can't put him with tame animals because he'll bite. And he explains to him that it's against the nature of a pig to live with these other animals, and he'll have to build a place for him. He said, well, the boy said, it mustn't be very large. He said, yes, it must be. He said, do you know that before this pig is ready for slaughter, it'll weigh up at least 300 pounds. So he said, you'll have to build a big place for it. But they all, he speaks like the, like a Vermonter, you know, in that Vermont vernacular. And it really is wonderful the way this person who wrote this book got that all down. I think that's odd. It's a very rural story, but very natural. And I think that's why everybody likes it. It's on the church reading list.
I didn't know there were Shakers in Vermont.
I didn't either.
Where was this?
I've forgotten the name. Well, I guess he just uses fictitious names for the place. But I didn't know, what do Shakers do? They're not like Quakers, are they?
I'm afraid I don't know. They're related in some way.
Are you acquainted with Artemus Ward?
Yes,
yeah.
I know
He wrote an essay about the Shakers that I read many years ago. Oh, I think it was just wonderful. I like him. His name really wasn't Artemus Ward, it was something else. I've forgotten. That was his nom de plume. But I've forgotten what his name really was.
Do you know why they were called Shakers?
No.
They had a community dance, and the women on one side of the hall and the men on the other, and they advanced in ranks together, and they shook their hands like this,
mm-hmm.
and shook the evil out of their bodies and minds.
Before they
out of
dance?
Their fingers. No, as they danced.
Oh, as they
see, a whole line of men, there'd be four or five rows coming forward like this,
uh-huh.
and as they danced forward, singing, they shook the evil out of their fingers.
Such a
like
belief.
This. So they were called Shakers.
Well, you know, in the Orthodox Jewish religion, the men and women never sit together in the synagogue. They sit in different places. In the Orthodox synagogue, of course, the Reformed have the, is like, the Reformed Jewish prayers and places of worship are just like the Protestant. Just exactly, because I've been to both, but the Orthodox are entirely different. They're the women see when a man meets his God and prays to his God, he isn't supposed to be diverted
yes.
by any other thoughts. Just have his thoughts on that.
Yes.
So the woman is taken out of his way. And then she stays up on the balcony somewhere. But they never sit together in the synagogue. I was reading a very interesting article in the New York Times. You know, there's a sect in the Jewish religion called Hasidim.
Yeah.
Hasidim, have you ever heard of that?
Yes, I have.
And they're becoming very prevalent in the United States. They have, and there's a lot of people who are donating money towards that. And they have buses like, and they go to New York City and they hand out, you know, like missionaries. But if they ask anybody, are you Jewish, and they say no, they take that thing right away from them, whatever the script, whatever
mm-hmm.
it is, they take it away from them. And these Hasidim, I really don't know much about it, but it's a very, very ancient sect. Now, Louis, for instance, he belongs to a sect called
Kohanim.
Kohanim. They're supposed to be the priesthood.
Same as the word Kohen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same as the word Kohen.
Yeah. See, they're supposed to be the priesthood
yes.
of the Jewish religion. They're supposed to conduct the service. They're supposed to conduct the prayers, and everybody's supposed to wash their hands. You know, I know, it's all symbolic, I guess. Religion is all symbolic, don't you think? It's things that they do is a symbol of the things. They're supposed to represent something.
Mm-hmm.
To me, they might seem senseless, but if I knew the background of it and why it
mm-hmm.
exists, then maybe I would know. know
this
why
is
they
true
do
of any church service, don't you think, Esther?
Pardon me?
It's true of any church service.
Yeah, everything is symbolical.
I think I've discussed with you before the novels of Chaim Potok. He's a New York rabbi.
Yeah.
He teaches in
he
one
wrote
of the...
The Chosen.
Yes.
And have you read any of them?
Yes, I've
read
the two of Chaim Potok's. Uh-huh. And in one of them, he has a lot about the Hasidim.
Oh.
You get a very vivid picture of the Hasidim. Mm-hmm. There's one member of the sect there who is very much an anti-Zionist. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of him when we were talking about Zionism the other day here. And his reasons for being opposed to the whole Zionist movement is very interesting, because he feels it's going to be partly secular and partly orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't stand the idea of a Jewish homeland that will be anything but purely orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
So he's doing everything he can to block the efforts of the Zionists, collecting money, for instance, in New York.
Against Israel, against the state of Israel.
And he's interpreting the word Israel in its strictest religious, solutional sense.
Orthodoxy?
Well, he wants a purely religious state. I guess there's a whole party in Israel now that would prefer to have a religious state than a kind of mongrel state
There's a party that doesn't. The younger people want to be Israelis.
Yes.
Israelis and not Jews.
Yes.
See, that's what I read. You know who wrote who writes short stories very well? He got the National Book Award. Isaac Beisheva Singer. Do you know him? Oh, I think he writes wonderful. He's a wonderful storyteller. As soon as he starts a story, it sounds as if he was sitting opposite you and relating his story. And you know, he wrote a book, well, he wrote quite a few books, but one that I like very much is My Father's Court. Have you read that?
No. Does he go back to the old country? Is he a Polish in origin?
Yeah, he's Polish, and he writes in Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
But he and an interpreter translate all his stories, and his stories were nearly in every issue of the New Yorker for a while. But now, I don't know what he's doing. I think he's the editor of the Forvex, the Jewish newspaper in New York. And I think he's a wonderful storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
In this My Father's Court, you know, his father was a rabbi in Warsaw, Poland.
Yes.
That's where he was born. And, the father was a sort of a legal advisor, a marital advisor, everything, any trouble that any family had, they would go to him to help solve it or to talk their hearts out or whatever it was. And this book, My Father's Court, is all about the different characters that came to his father's court.
Mm.
And it's a gem. You ought to read it. You'd enjoy it. Oh, there's one time when he's just a young boy when all this happened. And one time he runs away from home. And the scene, that stayed in my memory. Oh, it was really a lyrical thing that he wrote about running away from home, being on the streetcar, and I don't just remember where he went, and I don't remember every incident of it, but I could like to read that chapter over again. It was just so beautifully written.
Esther, is this the traditional role of the rabbi in a Jewish community?
Yeah.
He's the marriage counselor and a lot of other things, too.
He used to be, of course. I don't know. Well, it's the same way if people have trouble here, they go to the minister.
Some of them do. Yeah. Others go to shrinks.
Yeah. Well,
not to the minister. They go to the priest.
Well, for instance, somebody here was having marital troubles, and one of their friends went to this young minister to ask them about it. What can he do? Well, what can he do about it? If the man doesn't love his wife anymore, he can't.
He
can't do anything about it. I think this man is a very honest man, Mr. Travers. He doesn't make any hocus pocus about anything. He just told you. I told you about the cookies, didn't I?
No.
Did I? Well, one day I was, you know, I bake some oatmeal cookies that everybody likes, and one day I was mixing up these oatmeal cookies when the telephone rang, and I answered the telephone, and I always like to have the recipe that I'm using next to me, and this one happens to be on an oatmeal box. So when I went back after the telephone conversation, I continued to mix up the cookies, and I forgot to put sugar in them. When I was baking them, they were terrible. I didn't know what happened to them. So I said to myself, well, I will have to eat them somehow. And who comes in but Mr. Travers? And I said, can I make you a cup of tea? I said, I just made some cookies that have no sugar in them. Would you like to taste them? So I made him a cup of tea, and I gave him the cookies. And when he got through, I said, how did you like the cookies? He said, well, they'd be better with sugar in them.
Well, with the price of sugar what it is, maybe you'll be cooking.
Well, it wasn't such a high price, then, so I couldn't use that as an excuse. I just forgot to put it in.
Yeah.
Because I got diverted from my job by the telephone. I told him that someday I'm going to bake some with sugar and I'll bring it to him to see how much better they taste. I said, for telling me the truth. That thing that you just brought over is some chocolate frosting. See, where Mildred and I don't know who else is going to the parsonage for Thanksgiving dinner. And
the Travers will be back by then?
Yeah. The youngest.
Are they gone?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, he had to go to be with his father.
Well, how do you have him then?
Open heart surgery.
Oh,
He's been gone for 3 weeks.
He's gone 2 weeks.
Oh, she's here.
No, she went too. She stayed here a week after he did. She stayed here. She was at that party that they had that where you spoke about the Indians.
Great authority on the Indians.
So I have to bake a birthday cake. No, I have to. I want to. See, everyone brings something, you know, towards the dinner, because after all, they're not millionaires. So last year, I made a birthday cake for the little girl, the youngest one. I think her name was Gretchen, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. And this year, I'm going to bake a birthday cake.
Mm.
So I got the... You know, with sugar as expensive as it is, and you don't like to use any more than you have to, so I got a cake mix and this chocolate frosting, and I'll make it out of that. And it's more expensive than using it from scratch, but that suits me very well. It's easier and it's better. You have enough sugar left for yourself, because that kind of a white cake takes an awful lot of sugar.
Mm.
So I wouldn't have to use sugar. All I have to use is eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And mix it up. Make two layer cakes, two layers, and then put the chocolate frosting on it. And then I have some birthday candles, and I'll bake those too.
Have you ever baked a cake for a diabetic patient who mm-hmm. couldn't take any sugar? Mm-hmm. I wonder what they put in. Cake.
Oh, you know what I really want? I really want that recipe, if Teddy would give it to me, for that sponge cake that she made over there. Oh, it was just delicious. It had such a wonderful flavor. And she said that she didn't use something I don't believe.
Baking powder.
Oh, baking powder. Uh-huh. Well, it was very, don't you think that's very good cake?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I love it. It's...
She hadn't baked it for years and years, and she didn't have the recipe,
mm-hmm.
and she was worried that she couldn't remember the way her family used to bake it. Oh, years ago.
Well, sometimes I don't have a recipe for things that I like to make, but I try to do the best I can from what I do remember.
Didn't you think that immigrants' dinner was a lot of fun?
Oh, it was wonderful. I enjoyed every minute of it. Mm. I didn't eat any of the stuff. I couldn't eat the stuff.
Oh, wasn't there anything there?
No, I'll tell you what happened. I was sitting there,
just watching this big line of people who were getting there, and I wasn't going to stand in line. In fact, I didn't go there to have anything to eat anyhow. I just went there because I wanted the sociability. Excuse me.
Well, cum laude means with praise.
Yeah, with praise, yeah.
It means what?
Is that Latin?
Yes, Latin.
Yeah, I thought it was Latin.
With praise.
Yeah. I have a...
You're one of the people around here who really uses a dictionary, Esther. Remember that story about you?
Oh, yeah. About me and the dictionary.
Yeah.
Well, I play Scrabble.
Do you play with Louis? Does Louis play Scrabble?
He doesn't anymore. Oh. He doesn't want to play anymore. I like to play Scrabble better than anything else, Phil.
I like to play a game that's action in it.
No, completely absorbs me. I like words anyhow. And I play.
I may be an old man, but I'm not an old woman.
What do you mean, games that have action in them? Hopscotch? I haven't seen you playing.
No.
That has mental activity.
I'm out of that, then.
And I don't like cards. They don't do anything for me. I hate to play cards. I feel it's just a waste of time. But Scrabble, there's an article about Scrabble in this month's Harper's. You know, some people are, it's like chess. Some people are really geniuses at it. They can get a score of 700. But I'm not, the most I ever got was over 300. Mm-hmm. I never got any more than that.
Who do you play with, Esther?
Well, in the summertime, I play with Dorothy Swift, Mrs. Gulick's sister, with the gray hair.
Yes.
I play with her a lot. And she's taking chemistry and biology. But I'm not, don't mean to be immodest, but most of the time I beat her.
Oh, really? Good for you, Esther.
She's a graduate of Oberlin, and I'm the graduate of the School of Hard Knocks, but lots of times I beat her. but that isn't anything. I'm interested in words, and I have a pretty good memory. But I just love to play Scrabble. You know, I forget about everything else when I play Scrabble. And that's the purpose of a game. When I play cards, my mind wanders away from it. And I just hate it. It doesn't...
I've played a few games of Scrabble, but I get too tense and wrought up.
No, I don't get it.
Makes me exhausted.
On Sunday night, Raymond came down and played with me, but he thinks very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
He's slow.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, he's 64 years old.
Is he?
Yeah, and I'm nearly 20 years older than he is, but I think faster than he does. But then, that's the kind he is. You know, he's a very well-educated man. He's a graduate of Middlebury College.
Yes.
And. But he's, I don't know, either he's shy or he's not a good salesman. He doesn't know how to put himself over, but he's a very nice person, and I like him. He's my good friend. His mother and father were our friends, too.
Mm-hmm.
I remember years and years ago we had Thanksgiving dinner with him, oh, so many years ago. And now he's alone, and he has a terribly lonely life, I imagine.
He must, yes.
A very lonely life. And a few weeks ago, he had a cold. And then I called him up. I call him up once in a while to ask him how he is.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a good person.
We see him at the Grange after the church at the coffee hour.
He's a deacon of the church.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We like him very much. He has a nice, dry wit.
Yeah,
you know?
Very. You know what I think is funny? One time he was telling me he saw a cartoon in some magazine where there was a big party and women were all wearing décolleté. You know
what
that is?
Yeah.
So the caption under this cartoon was, "Women always say they have nothing to wear and now they're wearing it." yeah, he has got a very quiet wit. Mm-hmm. He's Well, I think once he beat me in the Scrabble. We played quite a lot during the winter. Now, during the winter, he has a job up at the Sterling School. He's the night watchman. But I was telling him the other day, I hope he isn't going to take that job this year, because he's getting older and getting out in storms. And anyhow, Walter Cronkite said there's going to be an epidemic of the flu this winter. So people better watch out. He said it started in New Zealand, he said. Mm. So I don't know whether he'll get the job or not. Of course, he's glad to go up there, because it breaks up the monotony of his being alone all the time. But
if he's a night watchman, he has to stay the whole night up there?
Yeah, the whole night, from 11 until 7 the next morning. Mm. And I don't think that's any fun. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it to earn money. Because what does he need it for? I guess he has enough money to take care of himself.
Who is the woman who owns the house that he's living in and remodeling?
You know that von Rosenberg's countess or whatever she was, a countess. Von Rosenberg, that used to live here, that's her daughter.
Oh.
See, she owns that house, you know, on Harvick Street.
Yes.
On Harvick Street,
yeah.
Yes.
Right opposite Mrs. Hibbert, I think.
Yes.
That's full of beautiful glassware, I understand. Mm-hmm. This Countess, is that her name?
Does she still come up here in the summers?
Oh, she's dead. The old woman is dead.
Oh.
But this woman, I don't know when she comes here. I really don't know.
Who?
This woman who owns the house that Raymond lives in.
And she's the Countess's daughter.
Yeah, she's the Countess's daughter, but I don't know whether she calls herself a Countess or not. You see, they're Americans, but they married, her mother married somebody.
A German Count.
Of an old Count.
Von
Rosenberg.
You can't retain a foreign title if you're an American citizen.
No, that's good.
Lily, you had to drop, Count, you had to drop your title.
Yeah.
Count von Kesselmann.
Count of no account.
Yeah, you're just plain Louis now, you're no count.
You know, I was telling you something funny. I think it's funny. You know, I always want Louis to help me in the house, and he doesn't like to do it. So I tell him that he and the Tsar must have had the same valet.
Do you ever hear, Louis, that a man is a hero to everyone but his valet? His valet knows him too well to make a hero of him.
Well, I don't think anybody ought to have a valet if they're well enough to do things for themselves.
No.
I don't think that people should be so spoiled, even if they do have money, that they can't do some things for themselves.
I was reading a story once about a woman who had grown up as a little princess, and she didn't know how to open a door when she got to be an adult. She'd always had a footman go ahead of her and open the door. She didn't know what to do with the doorknob.
What do you think of that? Wasn't that stupid? You know, Virginia Lohngren?
Yeah.
Well, you know, they were wealthy people, I guess. You know, the Pleasants were very wealthy. And her mother never believed that she ought to do anything. You know, they had plenty of servants in those days. You can get them. But when she married Siegfried, he's a Swede. And his family, his father was a bishop, I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
He was over here when they were married.
Yeah.
We met him over on the point.
Yeah. Well, they were married in Mrs. Pleasance. You know, did I ever tell you that I was with Mrs. Pleasance when Louis had a heart attack in 1944? We were in New York. And Louis got a coronary thrombosis.
Oh.
And he had to be in the hospital for 6 weeks. See, we went down to New York, it was in April, On Wednesday night, Wednesday I was in the library, and we were going to go to New York for a few days. And I remember I came home from the library, and I washed and ironed all of Louis's white shirts, I don't know, to take him to New York. And I don't know, I was up until about 12 o'clock at night. And the next morning we got up, we had a car, and we went to New York. We got to New York, and we were glad to be away from the, you know, April is a terrible month.
Yeah.
And it's awful, you know, the snow is melting, it's muddy, and, you know, it's terrible. So we went down to New York. We got there on Friday morning. We got there Thursday night. And when we got off the train at the Grand Central Station, I said to Louis, let's stay at one of these hotels. You know, there's a lot of hotels, so, and then tomorrow we'll see what we'll do.
Didn't we go by car? Did we drive the car?
Maybe we did. Yeah, well, how did we get to the Grand Central Station if we drove the car? No, we went by train. He didn't have any car. Remember, we walked everywhere in New York. So he said, no, let's call Lily up. That was a friend of ours, Lily and Julius Hurwitz. And let's go and stay with them. I said, oh, Lily, I don't want to bother anybody. Let's stay here. Let's stay here. But he insisted. And we went over to Lily and Julius, and we stayed up nearly all night visiting, which was terrible. We shouldn't have done that. And the next day, we went to see Mr. Miller. You know, Cyrus Miller, did you know him? He was a very good friend. He had an office on 42nd Street. He was a lawyer. Miller and Bretzfelder was the name of the firm. And we had a visit with him, and the next night he was going to have us for dinner at his house. So, then we left Mr. Miller, and we were taking a walk up 7th Avenue, and Louis went in and bought a pair of tweezers, or what was it?
Yeah, tweezers.
And we were so happy, you know, to be free.
Yeah.
We were just free on our own. Then I called up my brother's house, and my sister-in-law invited us for dinner that night, Friday night. And in the meantime, Lil called up and said that his housekeeper isn't well, and could we wait for a few days to have dinner with him? And we didn't care. As long as we were away from here, we didn't care what happened. Well, we went to my brother's, and we had dinner, and then it was time to go to bed. And Louis felt sick, and my sister-in-law and I were up with him all night.
I woke up at 1 o'clock.
Yeah. And all night long, and we thought he was having indigestion. And we made him lift his arms up and down, and we made him do everything, but it didn't help. And you know, it was during the war, where no doctor would come out. And we just went through the whole night trying to do this, that, and the other thing for Louis. Finally, 7 o'clock came. I said, oh, thank goodness we could call the doctor now. And he said, don't call the doctor, I'm going to walk there. And it was a big avenue block to walk to the doctor. And I said, Louis, let's call the doctor. I'm afraid to let you walk. I didn't know what was the matter with him. Well, we both walked down to the doctor, I don't know, very early in the morning. It was a little after 7. And he'd have to stop every minute. You know what, did you ever see Emil Jennings, that German actor?
Oh, yes.
You know, could tell what his moods were by the droop of his shoulders. That's all. That's how he was. He had to stop every minute and give his bend forward. Well, we got to the doctor's finally, and he came out of his bathrobe. He rang his bell. And I told my husband has been terribly sick all night. I said, well, will you please see if you can see what's the matter with him? And he put his stethoscope to him. He said, oh, your husband has to be rushed to the hospital right away. He's had a very serious heart attack. Well, you know, that came down like a thunderbolt. Well, where could we go? Didn't know any hospital. And besides, it was during the war, the hospitals were understaffed and you couldn't get into mm-hmm. hospital. So he was taken to the, what's the name of the hospital, Louie? Lincoln Hospital. It was all colored nurses, but white doctors. It was a city hospital, and he was put into a ward with about, I don't know how many other people. And he was terribly sick for a few days. They had him under intensive care.
Mm.
And I really thought he was gonna die then. And oh yes, I must tell you this. This is important. You see, I used to take care of Fred Pleasant's house, you know, where the Myers now live.
Yes.
And he would come up weekends and he would call me up. He was living in Massachusetts then in Cambridge. And he would call me up and tell me he was coming in to fix some dinner for him.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very nice association. I enjoyed it and I was earning a little money too. Which wasn't important, but it was I had a lot of fun doing it. But, you know, Fred is very witty. He's very, very witty. Well, anyhow, I wanted to let Fred know that we were in New York. Of course, if he wants to come up here, let him, but I wanted him to know that I'm not there to fix his dinner. So he was living at the Princeton Club then, and I called him up and he wasn't in. So the man told me to call him at breakfast time. He's always there at breakfast. So the next day by breakfast time, Louis was in the hospital, and I called Fred from the hospital, and I told him, you know, in 15 minutes, Fred was there,
mm-hmm.
you know, at the hospital. I told him where it was. He got a taxi to bring him up. And I remember they were just wheeling Louis into the ward, you know, away from, I don't know where they took him up in an elevator. I can't remember all that. They took Louis away, and all I had left of Louis was his clothes. And he's gone. And then Fred said to me, have you had your breakfast? I said, no. He said, well, come on, we'll have some breakfast. He said, and don't worry about anything. He said, Louis is here and he'll be taken care of and you take care of yourself. He was really so nice. Well, I went home and I was staying at my brother's. Oh, and it was terrible there for me. I hated it. Up three flights of stairs and the apartment.
Fireflies.
Yeah, well, the stoop was very high.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a terrible day for me. Oh, it was just mm-hmm. terrible. Well, Fred called up. I told him where I was staying. My brother had a telephone. He called up. He said, you know, my mother is coming home from Florida. He said, and she engaged a person to come and stay with her, but this person took sick. And I was wondering whether you could go over there and stay with my mother for a week after she comes home from Florida. See, it was in April, the spring.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, yes, I'll go. I thought anything would be better than my hanging around at my brother's house and worrying about Louis. I'd have mm-hmm. something to do to take my mind off all that.
Yeah.
So they told me how to get to Montclair. They lived in Upper Montclair, New Jersey. And I got there and Virginia and Fred were both there to greet me. And they were very, very nice to me, very. Mm-hmm. And then they went to get Mrs. Pleasant at the train or maybe Elmer Broder, I can't remember anymore. And of course I didn't know Mrs. Pleasant then and I was afraid of her, mm-hmm. you know, I really was. I thought, when I first came I met a woman at the store and she bought a whole bushel of oranges. Well, that was very foreign to me. All I could buy was one orange. And I came back, and I said to Louis, oh, Louis, there was a woman in the store who bought a whole bushel of oranges. He said, that must be Mrs. So,
yeah.
So Mrs. Pleasance and I, Virginia went back to her family, and Fred went back to the Princeton Club, and Mrs. Pleasance and I were left together.
Mm-hmm.
And before the week was over, Mrs. Pleasance and I were very good friends. She really liked me, and I liked her. I liked her the way she was, and she liked me the way I was. And after dinner, we would sit down in the little room adjacent to this dining room, and we would discuss the verities of life. And of course, my verities were entirely different than hers.
The truth is a relative matter.
So anyway. I said to her, you know, Mrs. Pleasant, you and I had entirely different backgrounds. I said, I started down there, and you started up there. I said, but there's a way of meeting in between. I said, but I can't think the way you do, because I didn't have the same background. So if you'll forgive me for telling you how I feel about things, I'm going to tell you. And I did. But she and I became such good friends, and she thought it was wonderful how much I knew about literature, and how much, but one time I quoted something from Samuel Pepys, you know, the diaries. Yes. She said, Esther, how do you know that when you didn't even go to college? I said, no, I didn't even go to high school. I said, I like to read. And then I stayed there, and every time they went to New York, they would take me to see Louis. And see, that was, and when I came in by bus, that was, it took an hour to come in by the bus, and then I would have to go down and shuttle over to the east side, and the subway. Oh, I had a terrible time. Mm. Well, and every time I went to see Louis, when I had to go by bus, Mrs. Pleasance would wait up for me to find out how Louis is, and what we intend to do, and she was very much interested. She said, you know, Esther, you're never going to go under.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I'm going to try not to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then Louis was through at the hospital, and he went to a convalescent home down there. And I came back here in July with Mrs. Pleasant. And I worked for her mornings from 12, from 8 to 12. I was supposed to go up there, gave her her breakfast and bed. And then she would read, and I was supposed to be going about my work. And then she would read, and she would find a paragraph in some book that she was reading that she thought would interest me. So she called me, and she said, oh, come over here, I want to read this to you, it's so beautiful.
Mm.
She knew that I liked beautiful language.
Mm.
So she would start, she would read this to me, and we would begin to discuss it. And the first thing you know, I look up at the clock, it was 11:30, and I said to her, listen, Mrs. Pleasant, am I coming up here to work or to get an education? Well, we had a very good time together. We really did. We had lots of fun. She had a wonderful sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And she appreciated me for what I was, and I appreciated her for what she was. And we. She died being my very good friend.
Mm-hmm.
And the week that I was supposed to stay there turned into years.
Mm-hmm.
I used to go up there and help her a lot, and I used to go through with all kinds of trouble. And you know what else I told her that I think was so good? You know, I said, I thought that people who were rich could be so happy. They could go wherever they like, they could buy whatever they like, they could do as they please. I said, but now I find that rich people are just poor people with money. Is that going to go in there?
Let's go in there.
Well, never mind.
Oh, that's a gem.
Huh?
That's a gem, Esther.
It is?
Sure. Rich people are just poor people.
Yeah, but she always was my friend. Always. She was... Well, I guess I better not go into that.
Well, you've had an awful lot of good friends here in Greensboro.
Yeah. She was...
People come here for good conversation, to get an education, Esther. They may have gone to college, but still, they need an education.
Oh,
so they
yes,
come
sir.
Here.
You know,
talk with Louie.
It was still Mrs. Pleasant that I became the librarian. You know,